Hear that? It's the call of the Crave. And when the Crave calls, you know what to do. Try the $5 Bacon Bundle. Because the only thing better than a White Castle slider is a White Castle slider topped with crispy hickory smoked bacon. So pick any two of either the Bacon Cheese Slider, 1921 Bacon Cheese Slider, or Chicken Bacon Ranch Slider. And also get a small fry for just $5 with the $5 Bacon Bundle. White Castle. Follow your Crave. Meet the next generation of podcast stars with SiriusXM's Listen Next program, presented by State Farm. As part of their mission to help voices be heard, State Farm teamed up with SiriusXM to uplift diverse and emerging creators. Tune in to Stars and Stars with Issa, as host Issa Nakazawa dives into birth charts of her celeb guests. This is just the start of a new wave of podcasting. Visit statefarm.com to find out how we can help prepare for your future. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
Hi, everybody. Welcome back to The Three Questions. I'm your host, Andy Richter. And today I am talking to Jason Isbell. Jason is an incredible musician and now a movie star. And he is, if I may say, my first return guest to The Three Questions. This podcast, I always felt like it was a one-shot deal, but they said, Jason wants to come back on. I said, well, I can't say no to that. This past year, Jason was profiled in his own HBO documentary film, Jason Isbell, Running With Our Eyes Closed. He released a new album called Weather Vanes, and he released the 10-year anniversary edition of his solo album, Southeastern. He also made his big screen acting debut in the new Martin Scorsese film, Killers of the Flower Moon. Jason joined me via Zoom, and here is my second conversation with the great, great Jason Isbell. Well, here I am again with Jason Isbell. And Jason, this is an auspicious occasion for this podcast because this podcast is not really designed for repeats. You know, the whole notion of tell me about your story, tell me about where you're going, and now what have you learned about your story? Yeah, like it, you know, it's like you don't come back on to go like, oh, I have a different childhood to tell you about,
unless you've done a lot of therapy in between episodes.
Yeah. You unlocked a lot of repressed memories or something.
Yeah, I just remembered.
Have you? Because that would be great if you did.
I don't think so. No, I think. I pretty much had it all last time. Yeah.
Then, you know, somebody said to you, you know, that you wanted to come back on or they was pitched to you. I don't know if it was, but I said, sure. Yeah, I would like it.
I would love
to talk to Jason again. So this is the first time I've done that. And there have been a couple occasions where people wanted to come back on. And I said, no. There's nothing. There's no more blood to be gotten from that turnip. So no. But I just, and I mean, you know, and I mean, we're, I just wanted to talk to you. And I figured we'd find something to fill out an hour. Yeah. And also, too, to prep for this, because I do occasionally prep for these things. I listened to our old one, which was interestingly enough, like right after all the January 6th inauguration shit. And we talked about that. And so it was just kind of interesting to hear us sort of laughing about that. Like, what a clusterfuck. What a bunch of bumbleheaded idiots. And it's like, oh, no. That's still very much with us.
Yeah. It's still here. They're still bumbleheaded idiots. Yeah. But they have had a significant act. Yeah.
Yes. And they're far more sinister than we even kind of imagined, you know, because we found out the sort of breadth of the just villainy, just the villainy of all these nice white folks. You know, that's the other thing too. It's like they're the, you know, these are the nice white folks. These are the real Americans. And they were shitting on the floor. Nice.
You know, I've never seen anybody behave worse than a group of the nice white folks.
Yeah.
It's, you know, you go overseas and you see them in England, and as soon as the sun goes down, they go from the most dignified people in the world to pissing on each other's feet in the streets.
Yes.
Yeah. And, you know, it was that way when I was a kid, too. It's like, the redneck fights are more just miserable to see than any kind of And then anything else. There's no group of people that can make a bigger idiot out of themselves than nice, polite white people with their shirt tucked in.
I think it was before I got off Twitter, I even noticed it was after they chose Mike Johnson. Is that his name? The speaker. And he gave a press conference and they're all sitting there so smug. And there was that one older woman that when they said, well, what about, the fact that you voted you didn't vote to certify the election. You voted against the certification of the legal upfront election. Mm-hmm. And this woman just went, shut up.
Yeah.
Like the dignity, the decorum, which they love to shove down other people's throats. But like, and I just was struck by these fuckers. These are the worst of the whites. Just that they're every fucking shitty woman at brunch talking crappy to a waiter. They're everybody, who just thinks they're right when they just are wrong over and over and over. Every gas bag sitting at the bar that makes you go, let's go home,
Yeah.
And I just wonder, like, if you have theories as to like why there is something so toxic about their anger and their fights.
The best I can come up with is the idea that they have been taught to base their self-worth on something other than their actions.
Yeah.
I think that's a big part of the problem is when you're not judging, am I doing a good job as a human or not, by your actions. You're judging it by who was my father, how long have I lived here, which land is mine, what is my last name, what school do my children go to, all these things that aren't, the one real thing that matters.
Yeah.
Then you get so defensive about that ego and that pride that you start to excuse your own behavior and you lose control of your patience, because the way to build good decision making is to judge yourself on your actions only.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so if you never do that, if you grow up thinking I am worth my last name, or I am worth the color of my skin, or I'm worth the house that I live in, you never practice being patient. You never practice being dignified. You only practice valuing yourself based on something you have no control over.
Yeah.
And eventually that erodes. You get to the point where you think, well, I'm a Smith, I can say whatever I want to say.
I'm a white person, I can say whatever I want to say. My family's been in control of this town or this acre or this house or whatever for so many generations, and it's my birthright. To me, the thing that always strikes me about it is, and it struck me about Donald Trump and I think why he resonates with so many people is that like, there's this kind of white daddy, John Wayne kind of, I don't follow the rules. I make the rules.
Yeah.
And if I decide to break the rules, it's because I make the rules. And I reality is just what I say it is. Like, I'm a good, upstanding citizen. Well, are you really? You cheat on your taxes. You cheat on your wife. No, I'm a good, upstanding citizen. And because look at me. Look at me. I got all the trimmings of being a good, upstanding citizen, when it's like, no, you don't. And also the world you've created with your amazing competence, it's not working. It's not so great. It's not being run so well. It's not so perfect. It's not, the things that you're doing are not taking care of everybody.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But I think the people he's getting with the con aren't necessarily the people who vote. I think what's putting him in the position of power are these leashes. I think there are leash issues. And a lot of this, I feel like, sort of started with Reagan. I know it happened before, but it really ramped up when the conservative political right figured out what they could use as a leash for the religious right. And they said, okay, if you're the only guy that is for pro-life, the term the ridiculous time, and we're all pretty pro-life, or we'd be jumping off a fucking building right now. But
which some days doesn't see, you know.
Yeah, I'm not always pro-life, Andy. Some days I'm against all of it, the whole thing.
Yeah, yeah.
But if you're not pro-choice and the other candidates are, there's your leash.
Yeah.
You can do or say anything, because these people think if they don't vote for you, they're going to hell. They're going to get a pitchfork shoved up their ass for eternity, you know, with not so much as a coffee break. And that's really the long, that's the horrible con to me, because after that, they have to keep doubling down until they actually convince themselves that they like it.
Yeah.
Because you cannot vote to kill a baby. If you think you're killing a baby and you're going to hell, you can't hit that button, man. Yeah, it doesn't matter what else. He could come shit in your children's mouths and you would have to vote for him. Because the other option is going to hell forever.
Yeah.
If we can't get those leashes.
Baby killer. Yeah.
Yeah. If we can't get those leashes off of people's necks, man, then we're just going to continue to get fucked by people who realize that they can keep pushing every other boundary, you know?
Yeah. 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 Cause that's the thing, you know, it is, you know, for evangelicals to be for Donald Trump. And, you know, I mean, and you hear it, you see it, you see people. Cause I think I can see the evangelical rationale that you're talking about, which is, look, I know Donald Trump is certainly not, he does not have a sparkling, you know, clean reputation, or he has not, he does not live the life of an evangelical saint, but he's going to follow all the, he's going to do all the things I want him to do. He's going to save those babies' lives. Like, I can understand that calculation.
But you're coming at that with a non-evangelical rationale.
I guess I am. Yeah.
They have been taught not to say what you just said, Andy.
Yeah.
They've been taught you don't eat off the tree of knowledge. There's a reason it was the tree of knowledge. They've been taught, don't question those things. If you have to go one way, then you go all the way that one way. Or else they'd do that with the Bible. If they would do that with Trump, they would look at the Bible and go, wait a minute, this doesn't make much sense to me, you know? So you can't start, that'll crumble. You start questioning, you know, you have to just go full on. You can't hedge any of your bets.
That's what I was starting to say, is that you do see like people online saying, you know, Donald Trump is like the most evangelical president we've ever had. He is the most Christian. Like they start making shit up. They start deciding what the reality is when, you know, anybody like that's, it's all, and it's, I think why it can feel so hopeless is because, and we talked about it a little bit on the past podcast. Look at Donald Trump. That's your boy. Your paragon of competence, of intelligence, of honesty, of you know purity. Like, don't look at him. Look at him. I'm looking at him, and I see what I see. And it's like, oh shit. How do you fight that? You know. I mean, how do you fight people that will force anything that crosses their radar into the box and fantasy of what they want it to be.
Yeah. I mean, you got to go back in time, you know, you got to go back in time and make that bottom number the same. The common denominator is not the same anymore. And it never was for everybody, but you know, you got to educate folks.
Yeah.
And once they're 30, 40, 50 years old, it's too late.
Yeah.
You know, you got to teach them how to like stop doubling down and admit, oh, I was wrong about this guy. Look at this guy. He's a fucking buffoon.
Yeah.
You know, or else they just keep on double. You know, it's like people gambling, man. You see the stupidest possible decisions. If you show up 2 hours into their blackjack game and they're losing, they're doing things and you're going, man, you're splitting tens here. There's absolutely no way you're getting your money back, but they're so far into it. You just showed up at the end. You know, we're showing up at the end of these people's lives and saying, why didn't you learn how to look at this guy and know what he really is?
Yeah.
That's because they have been trained to accept this for their whole life. And everybody around them has kept doubling down on this, you know.
Yeah.
If you're gonna take pride in this, you're gonna take pride in America and in our exceptionalism. And yeah. you're going to take pride in the fact that we run the world and we make the rules and we're in control and we come first, you know. And you can't show up that late and say all of a sudden, you know, why are you not seeing the same reality that I'm seeing?
Yeah. We touched on a little bit last time, and you and one of the things that you said about, you know, that your first marriage and that one of the you kind of said, I wasn't supposed to be married, but I had so much religious programming in my head. And you were raised in a Pentecostal church and the Church of Christ, which is pretty hardcore.
Yeah, it's
fundamentalist. And I wonder if you'll talk a little bit about like what that programming was like and when it started to come undone and where you are now in terms of questions of faith.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I've talked to my dad a lot about this recently because he was raised like full on in the Pentecostal church. So he dressed differently than the other kids. You know, they didn't take like over the counter medication. You know, he looked very different. And when he went to school, he looked very different. And just recently, you know, I've sort of, because dad's always had, you know, labor intensive jobs. Nobody's ever really hired him for his mental acuity.
And it's mostly house painting, right? Was he
house painting? And he did maintenance at a hospital for a long time. And then he went back to house painting because he was working more than he wanted to. He couldn't make it to all my ball games and school functions and stuff. Mm. So he took a pay cut and went back to working with his dad painting houses. And and then eventually I hired him a few years ago because he you know, he wasn't making a whole lot of money. And I was like, man, I'll pay you more than that to just come maintain our property. So that's what he does now. But we've talked a lot about the fact that, you know, when he was a kid, if there was a book report that you had to get up in front of the class and present, he would just take a zero, even though he'd read the book, completely understood it, you know, had no problem turning in a written report. He couldn't get up in front of the other kids because he felt this sort of shame at being different. And he was different because of the obvious religious indoctrination, you know. Mm-hmm. And I think for his parents, it may have been more of a necessary tool, you know, because they came through the Depression with a whole bunch of siblings. And I think they wound up with hammers and they needed, you know, screwdrivers. And so, you know, they taught their kids the thing that had worked for them. And then my dad and my mom kind of, you know, looked at the situation, even though they were teenagers, and said, we're not going to keep doing this. You know, I don't want him to feel different.
Is this after your birth?
This is when I was a kid. Yeah.
Yeah.
And dad and I talked about this about a week ago. Actually, we went to the SEC championship game in Atlanta and talked about it on the way. But, you know, he said that he made a conscious effort to not raise me as fundamentally, you know, Pentecostal Christian as he had been raised, because it was a source of shame for him to feel different in that way from everybody else. So when it was time for me to get up in front of people, I didn't mind. And it was kind of like baffling to my parents. I think the first time I ever did it was at like Opryland, the old theme park, country music theme park here in Nashville. And they wanted a volunteer. And I just ran up the stage and got on stage. And they're like, what the hell is this? Who is this kid? You know, like, and I loved it. And I've always loved it since then. But that to me was a very significant, you know, decision that they made, because it led to everything that's happened in my life ever since then.
Was there a crisis of conscience in that case? Like, did they think they're going to go to hell because they're, you know, they're
probably a little bit.
Yeah,
probably a little bit. I don't think they think that now. I think over the, you know, they were kids, man. They were 19 and 17. So I think at the time, they probably felt pretty guilty about that. But they cared more about me than they cared about themselves, you know. And over time, I think they realized that, oh yeah, we're not raising a demonically possessed, sinful child. He's making a joyful noise in one way or another, you know. As far as like my particular religious beliefs now, you know, I don't really think it matters all that much. It's kind of the thing where, you know, if there's a God or if there's not a God, I still have to get up and put on my pants, you know, still have to take a shower and have some coffee and go to the gym and, you know, work on a song or go do my Christmas shopping or whatever. So yeah, I don't really confirm or deny, but it's not something that I use to make my day-to-day judgments at all, you know, because I just don't understand how, you know, you could do your best your whole life and try to be fair with people and try to be honest with people because you think it's the way you should be and not because of some reward in the afterlife.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you get to
the quid pro quo. Yeah.
Yeah. And then you get to the gates of heaven and St. Peter or whoever's like, nah, I mean, you did everything on paper, but you didn't believe that we were here. So you have to go to hell. Like, I don't, I can't buy that. I think, you know, you should do it because it is the right thing to do, not because you're going to get a whole bunch of stuff in the next life.
Right.
But I have a lot to be grateful for in this life. So I can understand how somebody who is just suffering through their whole existence, you know, would turn to religion, like some of the AME church, you know, the Southern Baptist Black churches. I had a lot of friends that went to church there, and I went to those churches some myself as a guest and was very moved because I think a lot of people, you know, they need that hammer because it keeps them alive and it keeps them hopeful. And for some folks, there's not much to look forward to in this life. You know, I got lucky that way.
Yeah, yeah.
Go spread the word. When you get a fresh, hot McCrispy from McDonald's and you can feel the heat coming through the bag, don't try to wait till you get home. Always respect hot chicken. The McCrispy. Only at McDonald's. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
Love the flexibility of working in all sorts of places? Well, working on the go seamlessly requires a strong network like T-Mobile. We have America's largest 5G network, so whether you're on a video call at the park or uploading large files at a coffee shop, we have the 5G speed you need. Whatever takes you on the go, T-Mobile's got you covered. Find out more at T-Mobile.com/network today.
Coverage not available in some areas. See 5G device coverage and access details at T-Mobile.com.
Meet the next generation of podcast stars with SiriusXM's Listen Next program, presented by State Farm. As part of their mission to help voices be heard, State Farm teamed up with SiriusXM to uplift diverse and emerging creators. Tune in to Stars and Stars with Issa as host Issa Nakazawa dives into birth charts of her celeb guests. This is just the start of a new wave of podcasting. Visit statefarm.com to find out how we can help prepare for your future. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
Can't you tell my love's a crow?
Is there still, because there is, you know, you talked about kind of the transactional nature of a lot of like the basic notion of religion and especially Christianity. Are there vestiges of that in you? Like, do you still have a little bit of you that worries like, I'm going to get, like St. Peter's going to go, sorry, Jason, you didn't, we told you, you know, you got to say the words, you got to, you know, do the thing. And then you see, you know, I don't know. You see Donald Trump saunter in right past you.
Just like, walking past.
Yeah,
me.
Yeah. Like, right this way, sir. Yeah.
I was wrong.
Yeah.
I think I've gotten all that out. But there is, to speak to that on a different level, there are motivations within me that could have only come from that kind of fear as a child. You know, there's a determination, and there's also the idea of, you know, the firm idea of what's right and what's wrong that I think built from there, you know, and start with all that hardcore Christianity, do a bunch of fucking therapy and you wind up here, you know, because I kept the parts of it that served me well. And that was this sort of like concrete idea of right and wrong. And so I'm decisive. And if I make a choice, I usually accept that it's the right choice. You know, it's the ones that I don't make that get me in trouble. When you look around and go, how did I get here? How did my life wind up like this? You know?
Right.
And I think I do owe a lot of that in my nature to being raised in that way. I think I've kept that, you know?
Yeah.
And also, man, I have a vast, just, I don't even know if it's appreciation is the right word, but it is really kind of a miracle, or about as close to a miracle as you could get, you know, that a bunch of people could come up with all these different religions that became so incredibly popular and worked so well for so many things. I mean, you know, if what you're looking to do is get people to follow you, holy shit, what a maneuver. What a book. Yeah. What a collection. Like, what the fuck? It's like they were all Taylor Swift and Beyonce, every single one of them. They were that good at making something that people wanted to consume and become obsessed with. And I mean, that's, if you want to hold yourself to a standard as a creative person, those fuckers knocked it out of the park, man. Because we're still sitting here talking about that shit right now. It's amazing.
Yeah. I think, you know, I'm sure that at some point science is going to understand what it is about the human brain and the way the human brain works that makes you come up with the notion of God. Mm-hmm. Like what that process is, because every human on the planet has done it. Like, there's no sort of like agnostic island, island of people that are just like, well, we don't think about it much. You know, we just sort of like, we get fish from the ocean and coconuts and, you know, and we live our lives. And like, everybody has, I mean, there's obviously this need, this very primary, primal need to explain things and to feel like you're more than just prey. You know, you're more than just an animal waiting to get eaten. And so, and we have big brains that like stories. We make them up, you know. But yeah, you're right. There is something, you know, I've never felt a real, I was involved in the Protestant church. We went to whatever Protestant church was closest.
Yeah.
But I ended up, as I got into my teen years, being very involved with the Congregational church in our town, which is a very, very, it was part of the, part of the United Church of Christ, which also has a lot of like Unitarian Universalist churches, which are the most sort of like, whatever you believe is cool with us.
Loosey-goosey. Yeah.
And ours was pretty loosey-goosey. I mean, there were people within our church that weren't so loosey-goosey, but generally speaking, we had a minister, and it was all connected to this minister. We had Larry Rezash, who was just a very inspirational, wonderful, amazing man. And when he was gone, I was gone, kind of.
Yeah.
But I never felt any kind of like religious conviction, you know, like but I do find myself feeling like, well, I got to know all these Jesus stories. Like, I got to know all these Jesus stories so I can understand the culture of the Western world that I live in, you know?
Yeah. Just the canon of literature
and
music. And, you know, it's a reference everywhere. I couldn't possibly keep it out of my songs if I tried.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, I think at the risk of sounding like the biggest blowhard that's ever lived, I think it's grief. I think God is grief. You know, I think that we needed a way, because survival caused us to stick together and, you know, evolving into a species that would survive and multiply made us love each other. And then when somebody died, we had to figure something out.
Yeah.
We couldn't just sit there and think they're gone.
Yeah.
It just hurt too much. And we wouldn't get up and we wouldn't go survive more and multiply more.
Or
and
see them again. Yeah, yeah.
Or, oh, right. yeah, yeah, or yeah, even yeah. imagine that they're going back to nature, that they're going into the stars, or that they're blasting off to another universe. We had to have something, because they can't just be gone, you know? And to me, the idea that they're just gone, you know, not that I 100% believe this, but it's comforting to me. You know, I think, well, that's that. They're done.
Yeah.
And when I'm gone, I'll be done too. So I don't care what you say about me or what happens to my money or my guitars or my legacy. Or I won't be here. It sounds kind of awesome. You know,
I'm right there with you. Anytime anybody has ever talked to me about like estate issues, I'm like, I don't give a shit. And like, you know, and it's the same thing. I have it written down that like, I want to be cremated and dumped into moving water. Because I just feel it's a waste of real estate to put me in the ground and then not be able to use that land for something else.
But clarify the moving water part,
Andy. I don't want it to be a pond. Yeah.
There's a lot of moving water out there.
Listen, honestly, flush down the toilet. I don't give a shit. And that's what I've said. Like, I think I had a conversation with my son about it where I was like, you know, but you can do whatever you want with me. You can stuff me and keep me in the corner. I don't care.
I don't give a shit.
It won't matter to me, you know?
Yeah. But that changes when you think about, for me at least, it changes when I think about, you know, my mom or my daughter. You know, that it's like for me, sure, I'll be gone. But it's hard for me to imagine that whatever that is, that's not their body, that's not their physical body, whatever it is that makes my daughter her, will one day just not be anywhere.
Yeah.
That I need a God for that.
Yeah.
You know, I start feeling like, okay, well, somebody's got to be right. Let's pick the best one, you know? And it's really hard to hold that line when it comes to somebody you care about that much, you know? Yeah. And I know it's just the old part of my cave brain telling me that's my job is to feel that way about other people, you know? So it gets complicated. I think love, you know, I mean, really when they say God is love, it comes right down to that, you know,
you
love people so you can all survive. And then you need to build a God out of that love. So you have something to tell yourself for when they're gone.
Yeah. Are you susceptible to that whole, well, don't you want your child to know a little bit, you know, to have some sort of religious structure in their life? Because that was something I always got. And my ex-wife, you know, she was from a very Catholic family. And I think there was some of that about, you know, she one time her mother came to visit us when my son was tiny and was taking him out. She's like taking him out for a suspiciously long walks. And she said, I'm afraid she's getting him baptized. And I was like,
oh,
she can baptize him 13 times a day. I don't care. Yeah. You know, whatever.
Yeah.
But there was that pressure of like, or that notion of, well, aren't you going to take him and give him at least a little taste of it? And I just always felt like, no.
Maybe to understand other people, you know, maybe from a sociological viewpoint, you know, like I'll probably give her Reza Aslan's books at some point, you know. It's like, I'd like you to know about Jesus, honey. Like historically, Jesus.
Yeah.
You know, but also if she gets that, if she finds it on her own, maybe it gets her through a little period of time when she would have been in danger otherwise, you know?
Yeah.
And if somebody else in her life shows her that, you know, you just have to watch, you just have to know your kids. So it's like, you know, well, you keep them from joining a cult and keep them from feeling so guilty all the damn time. Cause it's we're already feeling guilty just for taking up space, you know? But I think, you know, it's good to know what all these people are talking about and why they're all going to the same building every Sunday and most Wednesday nights and stuff. But you know, I think the only thing that really counts is this sort of firm foundation of your identity. You know, when you're really little, like 1 to 5, if people are telling you, hey, you're valuable, then you're going to be fine. And if they're not, then you're fucked. And that's it.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, one thing that's changed since the last time you were here is you weren't a big movie star back then.
I wasn't, not yet.
You're now a big movie star, you know? How do you feel about that? I mean,
I feel great.
I imagine it's got to be pretty damn fun.
It's amazing. Because of the, you know, the Scorsese movie, Killers of the Flower Moon, this was a wild thing to be involved in because I didn't. So we were in the middle of the lockdown and we couldn't tour. And I just told my agent at William Morris, I would like to try to be in a show or a movie. If somebody's doing something good, maybe I can get a small part. And so he went down the hall to Alex, the movie agent.
I've said that so much to them. And it just, I've never been in a Scorsese movie. I don't know what you got that I don't.
It's the accent, Andy.
Is that what it is?
It's the accent. I realized it when I got on set. They had this guy who was the dialect coach, and this man was a genius. You know, this man is like in his 70s, you know, Gucci tracksuit, walking cane, you know, bopping around the set, going over. Most of his time was spent telling De Niro how to pronounce the letter I in the way a Southerner would pronounce the letter I. That was the biggest part of his job. But the first day I got there, they cut my hair, they picked out my costumes, and they sent me to this dialect coach. And this man had been the dialect coach on the film Gangs of New York.
Wow.
Now, the two people that I know in my life who've had the hardest jobs in my mind were this guy, being the dialect coach of Gangs in New York, and my buddy Gabe, who used to be Kanye West's publicist. Those are the two people that I know that have had the most difficult jobs. Yeah. But we sat down and he said, "You just talk like you talk. I don't have any notes for you." And I was like, "Now I know why I got this role." So Alex at WME got me an audition. And Ellen, who's been casting movies for Marty for a long, long time, knew my music and gave me a shot. And initially it was going to be a smaller role, like a cameo type role. And I just did a bunch of work. I went back and read the source material and I studied all the characters and what had happened to them, found all the information I could find. And I went and watched David, who wrote Killers of the Flower Moon. I watched all of his Library of Congress readings and Q&As and got all the information on the story that I could possibly get. And told Ellen, you know, if there's a bigger part, I would like to try to get that. And because I was excited at this point, the story is, you know, such an incredible thing to help tell because it's something we should have already known, you know.
Yeah. And you're also still that same kid that ran up to the stage at Opryland.
Yeah, you're damn right. Yeah. Like, I'm the guy. I'm the guy. Even when I'm not, I'm like, I'm the guy, you know.
Yeah.
And like I told my wife, Amanda, I said, it's like playing bass for the Beatles. Because I'm not a bass player, but I can play the bass and they already have Paul. I have no idea why they've asked me to do it, but I'm not going to say no. So here I am playing bass for the Beatles.
And I might even ask for a solo.
Just after a few days. I'll slap something out there. it took a while for me to get comfortable. We had what really did it was, the night there's one scene with me and DiCaprio where we're kind of in each other's faces and we're in the living room at my character's house, Bill Smith's house. And we'd been going back and forth for hours, you know, riffing, just basically saying, "I'm going to kill you. I'm going to kick your ass," and going back and forth in every variation of that. And you could hear Marty laughing from the other room, watching his screens, you know. And it was in a tiny room. It was in the actual house in Bartlesville, Oklahoma, or Fairfax, Oklahoma. And so the house was 120 years old, and it was small. And we were, you know, the camera crew, there's 30 crew people all crowded and
jammed
tight,
in,
you know, jammed in, like holding cameras and boom mics and stuff. And Leo and I are like nose to nose, and somebody on the crew farted. And it was one of those where, you know, you could tell by the sound of it that they had lost this great battle. Like they had, you know, had done everything he could to keep it in. And
it's
you
a
could
fart
just hear
that,
it.
It's a fart that inspires sympathy.
It does. It does. It's like, oh
poor
man.
God.
But
yeah.
Nobody. So I start laughing. Because it's funny when someone farts.
Of course.
And Leonardo DiCaprio starts laughing because it's funny when somebody farts. But nobody on the crew, later on I was calling it Farticus, because nobody made a sound or turned their head. I was like, "I am Farticus. I am Farticus." The most professional people in the world, you know. Yeah. So the only sound is the fart. Of great loss, and then me and Leonardo DiCaprio laughing. And in my head, I thought, oh, that's a blooper reel. Now we're laughing at something. We're no longer in the scene. And Leo put the laugh right into character and continued with the scene. And all of a sudden, he was laughing at Bill and not laughing with me.
Yeah.
And I thought, oh, shit, that's why you know, one of us has a Best Actor Oscar and the other one is me because I just got outgunned. But that was the night when everything really got comfortable for me.
Yeah.
You know, because I felt like I did a good job and I felt like I belonged there after that. And it was fine. But up until that point, man, I was fucking scared. I was just like, I don't know what to do. How do I do this?
Yeah, that's what I was going to say, because I mean, I'm not a deeply trained actor. I'm a practiced actor. Mm-hmm. And I still, you know, if I don't do anything for a while and I come back, I feel like I don't really know how to do this. Mm-hmm. And the only thing I come back with is, well, you know how to lie, you know how to like say something that isn't true and try and give it all the window dressing of something that is true. You know, mm-hmm. like whether it's a prank or whether it's a joke or whether you're, you know, trying to get out of something. And so it, for me, you know, acting to me is like a lot of it is just like I'm not this guy and I don't really feel like, you know, like the you know, if it's a restaurant scene, you know, like, the, you know, the chicken's overcooked. It's like, I'm going to say this like a person as if I was experiencing overcooked chicken. And mm-hmm. Is that what you were going with? I mean, were you just like, you just scared and just doing whatever?
I was very scared. Like at first I was just scared and doing what everybody told me. But when I finally got sort of a foothold, it was when I realized that turning off all self-awareness was the trick for me.
Yeah.
Just doing things and not being anything.
Yeah.
Because like, you know, you probably have this, like this constant like tally rolling in your brain of like, you know, what is my spatial relationship to my soul? Like, what mm-hmm. am I doing? What am I thinking? Who mm-hmm. am I being? And turning all that off and just, you know, you pick up the pistol and you open the door and you step out onto the porch, you know, and eventually I sort of became the character when I could do that. Now I'm not good at it. I haven't practiced it a lot, but yeah, you know, I asked Lyle Lovett before I went, what to do. Cause he'd been in all those great, Altman movies, you know, he was in quite a few and he was always fantastic. And I asked him and he said, Bob Altman told me right before I went out to the, right before they said action on the first scene that I was in, he said, Bob came up and whispered in my ear, don't act. And that was it. That was the only advice he gave him. And so Lyle said, so that's what I'll tell you. Don't act, you know. And it was like, just completely eliminate. I am not acting right now.
Yeah.
I'm not acting. I'm driving a car. I'm riding a horse. I'm talking to my wife. I'm, you know, whatever you're doing, you're just doing that. So really, it was kind of an exercise in process and awareness for me.
Yeah.
You know, and I watching Lily Gladstone. You know, when she was supposed to be upset on cue, there was no acting. It was just like every terrible thing that had ever happened in her life was right here next to her face.
Yeah.
And she just opened that door and boom, you know. And I asked her about that. I was like, no wonder you people are all insane, because you just have to keep this catalog of misery right there at all times. I was so impressed by that.
It also really, I think, that kind of performing is somebody that's that good. It's, there's something a little scary to it too.
It's unnerving. And
it's like you said, it's like looking at a crazy person because like you said, she's not acting upset. She is upset.
Yeah.
So it's real, but it's not real. And the line between what's real and what isn't, it gets really muddy and murky, and it can't be good for you, for your personal life.
It can't
be good for your personal life.
And I think that the way Marty makes a movie, I think he orchestrates that also.
You know?
Because like Sturgill and I have been friends for a long time.
Right. That's what I was going to say. There were a lot of musicians in this movie. Sturgill Simpson was in it, and
Pete Yorn and Jack White. But Sturgill and I didn't see each other until our last day.
Yeah.
Every time when I'm going home, he's headed to set. When he's headed to set, I'm going home. Yeah. And after that happened about four or five times, we were like, I think somebody is planning this. Yeah, I think the governor's making this happen, you know? And I think it was that way in a lot of cases, because like the women who all played the Osage sisters, you know, they spent a lot of time together, and you know, some of it voluntarily, some of it just seemed like it just happened. Oh, look yeah. who I'm in a room with again. It's like, no, that motherfucker over there is godding us around.
Yeah.
To great effect. You know, Sturgill and I weren't friends in the movie, you know, so we weren't friends on the set. I mean,
yeah,
it's just, and I understand how that probably, like you talk about a couple, you know, forming on a movie set, that makes sense to me.
Oh,
because the good directors, they put you together with people that are, you're going to have chemistry that you can't create, you know, and it's just going to be obvious on stage or on screen. And so, yeah, those things start to get in your head, man. It makes sense.
Yeah. Does it make you want to do more?
This story, the way it was told, the way it all turned out, I would like to do that again.
Uh-huh.
As far as just acting, that's a lot of work, man. Those days are long.
Yeah. There's a lot of sitting around too. Uh-huh. I mean, I know there's like musicians sitting around, but acting sitting around, I think is.
Yeah. It's another level of hurry up and wait.
Yeah. Yeah.
But yeah, I think I will probably do it again. But I really love my day job. I love it more and more and more the older I get, and the more songs we get to choose from to play live, and the tighter the band gets, and the more we get used to each other. And I just really love my day job.
Yeah. Did you find that the kind of efficacy of forgetting yourself and just existing in the moment, is that something, do you feel that in music too? Because that seems to me like, and because I completely relate to what you're saying, don't act, just if you're going to be crossing a room, don't be like, I'm crossing the room, just cross the room.
Yeah.
And that is like, if you can manage to do that in your regular life too, you're going to, you know, it's good to do that. It's good to like, not be telling your own story all
the
time.
Cut out the middleman.
Yeah.
Cut out that middleman.
And always be kind of thinking like, how do I seem? What do I look like? What's going on? Just do it, you know?
Experience your life.
Yeah. And does that happen on stage with music too? I mean, is there a difference between a good show and a bad show that involves that kind of energy?
First of all, I don't know what a bad show is.
All right. I'm sorry.
I didn't mean to
insult you or anything. I mean, all right, let's just say other people.
Yeah, when other people have a bad show. no, there he is. I have had bad shows. It's been a while, but I have had bad shows. But there's a thing that it really it made me think about this a lot. If I can't remember the next lyric in a song, most of the time, like 8-9 times out of 10, if I just open my mouth and start sending sound out of my mouth, it will be the correct lyrics.
Uh-huh.
They will come out. It's kind of like when you leave a grocery store and you don't remember where you parked your car, so you just stop thinking about it and start walking.
I'll just
walk right to my car. There's something in my brain that's in the unconscious that registers these things.
Uh-huh.
And the way we do our shows, like I ran into Phineas O'Connor, Billy Eilish's brother Phineas, and we were talking about, you know, they have to play essentially the same show every night. Because they're huge pop stars and people want to hear things a certain way, and they got all these triggers and all these lights and all this stuff.
And it's all kind of programmed. I mean, it wasn't a lot of the music programmed. Yeah.
Yeah. But we improvise a bunch. We improvise a whole lot. Like, I don't play the same guitar solos from night to night. That improvisational thing, you know, that is all about flow state, you know.
Yeah.
It's all about just not judging what you're doing and going with it. And it's kind of the old hippie thing, the old Grateful Dead thing. And we do it within the frame of 3 or 4 or 5 minute songs. Like, I'm not going to get up there and jam all night. But if I have eight bars.
Thank you for that, by the way.
You're welcome. You're very welcome. If I have 8 bars to play a solo, I'm going to try to do something different every single night. And to do that, you got to stop judging yourself.
Yeah.
You have to immediately say, I'm not judging this, I'm just doing this. And that's a real trick that I've learned songwriting wise. That's probably helped me more than anything over the last 20 years, is how to not judge yourself until it's time to judge yourself.
Yeah.
The first time you're writing, don't do anything that slows you down. Don't look for connections. Don't try to write to the ending. Just make people, make characters, and follow them around. And then later on, you can go back and judge it as hard as you want when you're editing it. But I think that was the thing. It's like doing half of a songwriter's job when you're acting, because you're doing the part where you're not judging yourself. You're just being, and you're just creating constantly. And then you're expecting, you know, Marty and Thelma Schoonmaker to edit it, which they do a pretty good job.
They sure
movies,
do.
You know? Yeah. So, but what, if you trust them and the way they're going to make you look and sound and appear, then, you know, there's no, you don't have to judge at all. You just be, you just do things over and over and over, do things.
Yeah.
Love the flexibility of working in all sorts of places. Well, working on the go seamlessly requires a strong network like T-Mobile. We have America's largest 5G network, so whether you're on a video call at the park or uploading large files at a coffee shop, we have the 5G speed you need. Whatever takes you on the go, T-Mobile's got you covered. Find out more at T-Mobile.com/network today.
Coverage not available in some areas. See 5G device coverage and access details at T-Mobile.com.
Meet the next generation of podcast stars with SiriusXM's Listen Next program, presented by State Farm. As part of their mission to help voices be heard, State Farm teamed up with SiriusXM to uplift diverse and emerging creators. Tune in to Stars and Stars with Issa as host Issa Nakazawa dives into birth charts of her celeb guests. This is just the start of a new wave of podcasting. Visit statefarm.com to find out how we can help prepare for your future. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
Can't you tell my love's a crow?
Well, another thing that's new that I would be remiss if I didn't talk about is your beautiful new teeth.
Oh, thank you, Andy.
Yeah, yeah. Tell me about that, because I've read so much shit online about your teeth, about
really?
people like
are
talking
interested.
About it. They are interested. I mean, because and this is after the movie, right? You got it.
Yes,
it got fixed after the movie.
Yeah, the movie. Do you think I had my real cowboy teeth.
Do you think if you got them fixed before, you wouldn't have gotten to be in the movie?
I might have had to wear prosthetic teeth that looked like my old teeth, because that's Leo had on prosthetic teeth.
Really.
Yeah. So they may have made me wear prosthetic teeth. And I was thinking, I'll just make sure and wait until all this is over, because, you know, people didn't have perfectly straight pearly whites in 1924 in
Oklahoma.
They sure
didn't. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, now tell me, because something about, you know, there's a fantastic quote from Sigmund Freud that says, you can't fall in love with a toothache, which is, you know, and I mean, it's meant to say how, you know, the minuscule can affect the sublime. Mm-hmm. And I do know, because I mean, having had teeth issues or whatever throughout, like, is how, why did it take you so long to get it? I mean, you know, you probably got dental.
Not that kind of dental. I'm SAG after, they ain't covering that. but you know, honestly, this was the first time since I could afford it when I'd had a long enough period of time to recover from it.
Oh, really? How long? And how long was that?
Well, I didn't know how long it was going to take. It took a couple weeks, really, to get to the point to where I felt almost normal again. But I don't take painkillers.
Yeah.
So I still can't feel part of my chin. They had to do like a nerve block. But the first surgery was 8 hours. The second surgery was 6. My shit was fucked. Yeah, they pulled like 12 or 13 teeth. My wisdom teeth were still in there. One of them was pushing on my trigeminal nerve and causing me severe neuralgia pain in my face. And then I had tons of infection in my gums, like periodontal disease, and it was going up into my sinuses.
Oh.
Yeah, and I didn't know this. Like, I went to a dentist here in Nashville, and they said, well, you know, we can give you Invisalign. You know, everything else looks pretty much okay. But that did not turn out to be the case. When I got out to California to Dr. Sands, he was like, oh, yeah, this is going to take a lot of work. And sure enough, they said it was their most challenging job of the year.
Wow.
It was
You should be proud of that.
Yeah, I was actually. Yeah, yeah, I was like, that's right. I'm from, how many people from Alabama come in here, my friend? Because I had some Roll Tide teeth. Yeah. but I'm so glad. It's so much easier to sing now.
Is
like,
it? Yeah.
The higher range, the falsetto. And, you know,
is that a worry?
No, not really. Because, you know, people say that, like, they say Freddie Mercury, wouldn't get his teeth fixed because he thought it would affect his singing voice. I think it was a different reason. I think Freddie Mercury wouldn't get his teeth fixed because he didn't want to have to go in and give a bunch of medical information to people in the UK who might have made that public. Because, you know, there's a lot of things he didn't want people to know about himself.
Right.
For me, man, it you know, and yeah, it might have been a concern if I'd gone to somebody who did it in 1 or 2 days and did it for 10 grand, you know, and it was like the cheapest, quickest, but I went to the best person I could possibly find and they took their time. And, so I wasn't worried about it, but I really didn't expect it to be so much easier. Like when I sang Cover Me Up on, Colbert, that was the first time I'd really sang that song since I'd had the teeth fixed, replaced, and it was so much easier. I think just because the infection in my sinuses, I was having to push through so much shit just to get the notes there, you know. But I'm very, very happy with it.
That's great. I mean, and I mean, do the people around you notice? Like, is there a noticeable difference in your carriage?
Yeah, because I think I smile more, so people think I'm nicer. which could be a good thing and a bad thing.
What are you smiling because you got pretty teeth to show off and you were self-conscious, or are you smiling more because you're not in pain? You know,
yeah, it's a little bit of both. I think you know, you don't necessarily realize how much pain you're in until somebody relieves it, and then you're like, oh shit, that hurt really bad. Like,
yeah.
I mean, I'm not supposed to just always have a headache, because like when, you know, when I was drinking back in the old days, like if I woke up now feeling like I will, you know, feeling like I felt every single morning 15 years ago, I would think I was fucking dying.
Yeah.
You know, I would call I would think that I had cancer and that cancer had AIDS, and I would call a fucking medevac immediately, you know. but, you know, but then I was like, oh, yeah, this is just how I feel. I think you don't necessarily get used to it, but you get accustomed to it. You know?
Yeah. Do you feel, I mean, because I, you know, from when we talked, I guess it was in 2021, it was, you know, 2.5 years ago, something like that. I feel like there is a much, like you loom larger in the public consciousness now than you used to. Like,
yeah,
I think,
it was a big year.
Yeah. I think that, you know, before you were a very well-known Americana artist, but that's like saying, you know, a very famous square dancer. You know?
Yeah, the most popular shih tzu. Yeah.
And I mean, do you feel like it was just kind of a natural thing? Was there something that, was there like a publicist push, or was it just kind of a natural evolution of things? And how does it make you feel?
Well, I think all of it was owed to the fine people at the Oreo Company who are on this call silently right now. No, the truth of it is, it was a natural thing. It was, you know, I made a record that was really good, that was the best that I could do, and I produced it myself, and we tried really hard, and then, you know, I was also in a movie that was a really fucking amazing thing and a huge deal. And that documentary came out on HBO. You know, all these things sort of lined up. Also the fact that Cover Me Up, the song has become sort of a part of the canon, you know, so many people have covered it and stuff that's become a big part of it.
The guy, I can't remember his name.
Morgan Wallen covered it on his record. You know, I think all these things just sort of happened at the same time. The 10-year anniversary of Southeastern album, everything just sort of converged in a natural way. And I'm okay with it, you know. It serves my purpose, which is just to keep doing my job and keep being able to travel comfortably and, you know, take care of my family and have good gear and, you know, take care of my band and my crew and all this. It's not necessarily something that I had aimed for, but I'm okay with it, and I enjoy it. Once I've accepted that it's happening, then I'm going to try to figure out ways to have fun with it. But I'm 44 and I've been sober for almost 12 years. So, you know, if I can't handle that shit, nobody can. I mean, it's really, it's not that big a deal, you know?
Yeah.
It's all very, very positive. And, yeah. And it also gives me the opportunity to do things that I couldn't do otherwise. Like, you know, now if I pick all of our openers, and now when I bring an opening act out, I think the audience knows to show up early and pay attention. They treat them well. And sometimes that really helps people find an audience of their own, you know?
Yeah.
And then sometimes I just pick the people that I love the most, like Amy Mann. Yeah, she's doing Amy a couple Mann. Of big yeah, shows yeah. for us in a couple of months. You know, that's just for me. That's like, she's got plenty of an audience, but I just want to hear her sing again.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's always nice. I mean, that's anybody that does it sort of like take success and fame and leverage and angle it into just being like spending more time with their friends is yeah. doing it wrong. You know, that, yeah, yeah, you know, because yeah, yeah. that's the whole key. It's like if you're, you know, if it starts working, like that means, okay, well now the party can really begin, you know? Yeah. And if you do something else with it or start, you know, getting high on your own supply, as they say, mm-hmm. then you're sort of missing out on the point of it all.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Luckily, you know, that kind of thing didn't really happen to me until I was pretty much fully grown and I'd been in therapy for a long time.
Yeah,
so it's kind
yeah.
of easier for, you know, if I was 18 or 19, man, like, I don't know. I was at an event a couple weeks ago, the GQ party. My best friend runs GQ magazine. He didn't when we met. We've been friends for a long time. But, you know, Olivia Rodrigo was there. And, you know, it's just she's just like an adult. She's just fine. You know, she wasn't like drinking. She was just being nice and hanging out and saying very normal things. And I was thinking, yeah. man, when I was that age, if I had been 1/10 of as popular as her, you know, they would have been scraping me off the fucking ceiling of this place. Like I would have been a disaster. I would have burned this place to the ground, you know, yeah. with my own ego.
Yeah.
So I'm always impressed when somebody that age handles it well. Cause it's yeah. like, you know, I'm in my 40s. What are they going to do? You know,
yeah.
I still got to go get my fucking colonoscopy and stuff. You know, it's like, it's hard to get too full of yourself when you right, got a camera right. going up your ass, you know?
Well, you know, unless you know, what's on the screen is magical.
Of course, if there's diamonds and rainbows,
yeah.
it's like, I always knew it. Oh, I always knew that's what yes. was in my ass.
There's yeah. magic in me. Well, Jason, thank you so much for doing this again. And it was such a joy to talk to you. And this hour just flew by.
For me too. Thank you.
Sure. And I'm so happy that, you know, that you are enjoying all this stuff. And I do feel like it's not, you know, like if anybody can handle it with grace and aplomb, it's you. And, mm-hmm. and so, you know, I look forward to just everybody getting to know who you are and finding out the stuff that you really do, the music, you know.
Yeah. Thank you, Andy.
And sure,
I'm honored
sure.
to be your first repeat customer. That's a big deal.
Thank you. It was good. I was a little worried because like I say, when I listened to the first one, I was like, that was a pretty good one. It was
we
a good one.
We covered a lot of ground. Yeah,
we did. And I was like, oh shit, what am I going to talk about? But you know, we both have the gift of gab.
Well, you can talk that we
yeah,
can do.
Yeah. Love to everybody on your side of the world.
Same to you.
And thank you. And thank you all for listening. And I'll be back next week.
The Three Questions with Andy Richter is a Team Coco production. It is produced by Sean Daugherty and engineered by Rich Garcia. Additional engineering support by Eduardo Perez and Joanna Samuel. Executive produced by Nick Liao, Adam Sachs, and Jeff Ross. Talent booking by Paula Davis, Gina Batista, with assistance from Maddie Ogden. Research by Alyssa Grawl. Don't forget to rate and review and subscribe to The Three Questions with Andy Richter wherever you get your podcasts. And do you have a favorite question you always like to ask people? Let us know in the review section.
Can't you tell my love's growing? Can't you feel it ain't it showing? Oh, you must be a knowing.
This has been a Team Coco production.
Hear that? It's the call of the Crave. And when the Crave calls, you know what to do. Try the $5 bacon bundle, because the only thing better than a White Castle slider is a White Castle slider topped with crispy hickory smoked bacon. So pick any two of either the bacon cheese slider, 1921 bacon cheese slider, or chicken bacon ranch slider, and also get a small fry for just $5 with the $5 bacon bundle. White Castle. Follow your Crave. Meet the next generation of podcast stars with SiriusXM's Listen Next program, presented by State Farm. As part of their mission to help voices be heard, State Farm teamed up with SiriusXM to uplift diverse and emerging creators. Tune in to Stars and Stars with Issa as host Issa Nakazawa dives into birth charts of her celeb guests. This is just the start of a new wave of podcasting. Visit statefarm.com to find out how we can help prepare for your future. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.